on ABC Radio National. This is Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Robin Williams. Usually you can hear me every Saturday at noon on The Science Show, but for the next 4 weeks it'll be my pleasure to join you at this time to introduce the 2010 Reith Lectures from the BBC. The Reith Lectures began in 1948 in honour of the first Director General of the BBC, John Reith. They are an annual event, and previous lecturers include Bertrand Russell, Robert Oppenheimer and Anthony Giddens. For the last 7 years they've been presented and chaired by the BBC's Sue Lawley. And so to this year, and we begin at the Radio Theatre in Broadcasting House for the first in this series of four lectures. They're given by a man I've known and admired for many years, Lord Martin Rees, someone who's been called a scientific magician, a man who leaves you wondering where his sparkling ideas come from. Magic, however, is not his business. He's rooted in the pursuit of rigorous scientific inquiry, and his work has taken him to the pinnacle of his profession as President of the Royal Society of London, Astronomer Royal, and Master of Trinity College in Cambridge. He's called his four lectures Scientific Horizons. His subject is the challenge we face as we start our journey through the rest of the 21st century. Professor Rees believes we are in danger, as he puts it, of destroying the book of life before we've actually read it. We may be at the top of the evolutionary tree, but there are still many things we don't understand, and possibly never will. Indeed, the form of life of which we are a part may not be the only one in the universe. So, in Scientific Horizons, our lecturer will look at the threats to our very existence and explore some possible solutions. With his first lecture, Scientific Citizen, the 2010 BBC Reith Lecturer, Lord Martin Rees.
Welcome, Martin. You've been Astronomer Royal for the past 15 years, I think. I gather it's a deeply arduous task.
It was 50 years ago arduous, but I like to say the duties are so exiguous I can do them posthumously. I need never retire.
But you must get letters or emails from lots of people who think that they've cracked it, you know, that they've learned the darkest secrets of the universe. What do you do with all of them?
Oh, I get those. You do best to tell them to write to each other. Sometimes they hit it off. Sometimes you get a letter from each saying, why did you tell me to write to that nut?
But seriously, you do like interaction, don't you? You are not the kind of scientist who sits poring over his papers in his ivory tower for ages. I mean, debating, travelling, talking, lecturing is what you do.
Well, that's right. The science I do is fairly interactive. I have lots of collaborators. I'm interested in data obtained in different ways. But also, I derive less satisfaction, I think, if I could only talk to fellow specialists. I get more satisfaction from the fact that my subject is of gratifying interest to a much wider public than the professionals.
But puzzles and conundrums are what you do, and they're whirling away, one likes to imagine, in your head the whole time. Is that how you do your science? You think of a brilliant solution and then set about trying to prove that it's the correct one.
Well, sometimes I sit and think, sometimes I just sit. But one hopes that ideas eventually generate. But they generate more, actually, when they're stimulated by some new observation or by some remark made by someone else. It's a very interactive subject, but I'm very fortunate, actually. The subject I work in, astronomy, has been developing very fast. It was developing fast when I started, but the pace of change has not slackened at all.
Wonderful. Well, we hope also the debate here is going to inspire you, just as we hope you're going to inspire us, which I'm sure you are. Can I invite you to take to the podium and deliver your first lecture? It's called The Scientific Citizen. Thank you.
I'll start with a flashback to the 1660s, to the earliest days of the Royal Society. Christopher Wren, Robert Hooke, Samuel Pepys, and other ingenious and curious gentlemen, as they described themselves, they met regularly. Their motto was to accept nothing on authority. They did experiments. They peered through newly invented telescopes and microscopes. They dissected weird animals. But, as well as indulging their curiosity, they were immersed in the practical agenda of their era. Improving navigation, exploring the New World, and rebuilding London after the Great Fire. Today, Science has transformed our lives. Our horizons have hugely expanded. No new continents remain to be discovered. Our Earth no longer offers an open frontier, but seems constricted and crowded, a pale blue dot in the immense cosmos. My theme in these lectures is that the Royal Society's old values should endure. Today's scientists, like their forebears, probe nature and nature's laws by observation and experiment. But they should also engage broadly with society and with public affairs. Indeed, their engagement is needed now more than ever. Science isn't just for scientists. All should have a voice in ensuring that it's applied optimally and to the benefit of both the developing and developed world. We must confront widely held anxieties that genetics, brain science, and artificial intelligence may run away too fast. As citizens, we all need a feel for how much confidence can be placed in science's claims. And these are themes I'll explore in all four lectures. And as I'll discuss, this is a crucial century. The Earth has existed for 45 million centuries, but this is the first when one species, ours, can determine, for good or ill, the future of the entire biosphere. But first, a comment on how science itself has changed our perspective on nature. Last year, we celebrated Charles Darwin's anniversary. Darwin's impact on Victorian thought was profound, and he resonates even more today. His concept of natural selection has been described, with only slight hyperbole, as the best idea anyone ever had. His insights are pivotal to our understanding of all life on Earth and the vulnerability of our environment to human actions. Other sciences have disclosed the nature of atoms, of DNA, and of stars. Spectacular images from space have enlarged our cosmic horizons. It's a cultural deprivation not to appreciate the panorama offered by modern cosmology and Darwinian evolution. The chain of emergent complexity leading from some still mysterious beginning to atoms, stars, and planets. And how, on our planet, life emerged and evolved into a biosphere containing creatures with brains able to ponder the wonder of it all. This common understanding should transcend all national differences and all faiths too. Science is indeed a global culture, and its universality is especially compelling in my own subject of astronomy. The dark night sky is an inheritance we've shared with all humanity throughout history. All have gazed up in wonder at the same vault of heaven, but interpreted it in diverse ways. Today, I'm not going to speak further about the findings of science, nor will I extol it as the greatest collective achievement of humanity, though it surely is. I'll instead focus on how it impinges on our lives and how it will in future. Some changes happen with staggering speed. Everyday life has been transformed in less than two decades by mobile phones and the internet. Computers double their power every 2 years. Spin-offs from genetics could soon be as pervasive as those from the microchip have already been. 10 years ago, the first draft of the human genome was decoded. Now, genome sequencing, the readout of our genetic inheritance, is a million times cheaper than 10 years ago. These rapid advances, and others across the whole of science, raise profound questions. For instance, who should access the readout of our personal genetic code? How will our lengthening lifespans affect society? Should we build nuclear power stations or windmills if we want to keep the lights on? Should we use more insecticides or plant GM crops? How much should computers invade our privacy? Such questions didn't feature much in the recent election campaign here in the UK. That's partly because they transcend party politics, but it's more because they are long-term and tend to be trumped by more urgent items on political agendas. But often, science does have an urgent impact on our lives. Governments and businesses, as well as individuals, then need advice. Advice that fairly presents the level of confidence and the degree of uncertainty. Issues come up unexpectedly. For instance, back in April, the eruption in Iceland raised urgent questions about volcanology, about wind patterns, and about how volcanic dust affects jet engines. In that instance, the knowledge was basically there. What was lacking was coordination and an agreement on the acceptable level of risk. Sometimes, though, the key science isn't known. An example was the outbreak of mad cow disease in the 1980s. At first, experts conjectured that this disease posed no threat to humans because it resembled scrapion sheep, which had been endemic for 200 years without crossing the species barrier. That was a reasonable conjecture and comforting to politicians and public. But it proved wrong. The pendulum then swung the other way. Banning beef on the bone, for instance, was in retrospect an overreaction, but at the time seemed a prudent precaution against a potential tragedy that could have been far more widespread than it actually turned out to be. Likewise, the government could have been right to stock up vaccine against swine flu, even though fortunately this particular epidemic proved milder than feared. Indeed, if we apply to pandemics the same prudent analysis whereby we calculate an insurance premium, multiplying probability by consequences, we'd surely conclude that measures to alleviate this kind of extreme event actually need scaling up. And these measures, incidentally, need international cooperation. Whether or not an epidemic gets global grip may hinge, for instance, on how quickly a Vietnamese poultry farmer can report any strange sickness. Incidentally, there's a mismatch between public perception of very different risks and their actual seriousness. We fret unduly about carcinogens in food and low-level radiation. But we are in denial about low-probability, high-consequence events which should concern us more. The recent financial crash was one such, but others that haven't yet happened, lethal pandemics are one example, should loom higher on the agenda. The varied topics I've just mentioned show how pervasive science is in our lives and in public policy. President Obama certainly recognized this. He filled some key posts in his administration with a real dream team of top-rate scientists, and he opined that their advice should be heeded, I quote, even when it is inconvenient, indeed especially when it is inconvenient. The UK has chief science advisers in most government departments. Not yet, however, in the Treasury. Though I can't help thinking this would be worthwhile even at the sacrifice of one economist. Winston Churchill once said that scientists should be on tap, not on top. And it is indeed the elected politicians who should make decisions. But the role of scientific advice is not just to provide facts to support policies. Experts should be prepared to challenge decision makers and help them navigate the uncertainties of science. But there's one thing they mustn't forget, whether the context be nuclear power, drug classification, or health risks, political decisions are seldom purely scientific. They involve ethics, economics, and social policies as well. And in domains beyond their special expertise, scientists speak just as citizens. There's no denying where science has recently had the most contentious policy impact and where the stakes are highest. Climate change. It'll feature along with other global threats in my second lecture, but I'll venture some comments today too. As regards to science, there's a network of arguments that mesh together. But there is, in my inexpert view, one decisive measurement. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is higher than it's been for a million years and is rising, mainly because of the burning of fossil fuels. this finding isn't controversial. And straightforward chemistry tells us that carbon dioxide is a so-called greenhouse gas. It acts like a blanket, preventing some of the heat radiated by the Earth from escaping freely into space. So the measured carbon dioxide buildup in the atmosphere will trigger a long-term warming, superimposed on all the other complicated effects that make climate fluctuate. The predicted rate of warming, however, is uncertain. Calculations lead a spread of projections, depending on the poorly understood feedback from water vapor and clouds, which themselves affect the blanketing. Nevertheless, even the existing uncertain science convinces me that the threat of disruptive climate change is serious enough to justify its priority on the agenda of this country and others. This confidence may surprise anyone who's dipped into all that's been written on the subject. Any trawl of the internet reveals diverse and contradictory claims. So how do you make up your mind? I suggest the following analogy. Supposing you seek medical guidance. Googling any ailment reveals a bewildering range of purported remedies. But if your own health were at stake, you wouldn't attach equal weight to everything in the blogosphere. You'd entrust your diagnosis to someone with manifest medical credentials. Likewise, we get a clearer steer on climate by attaching more weight to those with a serious record in the subject. But, as I said earlier about science advice in general, it's crucial to keep clear water between the science on the one hand and the policy response on the other. Risk assessment should be separate from risk management. Climate projections still span a wide range, but even if there were minimal uncertainties in how the world's weather might change, there would still be divergent views on what governments should do about it. For instance, what balance should be struck between mitigating climate change and adapting to it? And there are other questions. How much should we sacrifice now to ensure that the world is no worse when our grandchildren grow old? How much subsidy should be transferred from the rich world, whose fossil fuel emissions have mostly caused the problem, to the developing nations? How much should we incentivize clean energy? And should we gamble that our successors may devise a technical fix that will render nugatory any action we take now? On all these choices, there's as yet minimal consensus, still less effective action. But policies and investment priorities are being influenced by climate change projections, so it's inevitable and right that climate science is under specially close scrutiny. We are today far more questioning of authorities on every topic. We can all access far more information and want to weigh up evidence for ourselves. Such scrutiny should be welcome, just as there are instances of shoddy work, error, or even malpractice in the medical and legal profession, so there occasionally are in science. But science is generally self-correcting. Scientists are their own severest critics. They have more incentive than anyone else to uncover errors. That's because the greatest esteem goes to those who contribute something unexpected and original, like refuting a consensus. That's how, in science, initially tentative ideas firm up, not only on climate change, but, to take earlier examples, regarding the link between smoking and lung cancer and between HIV and AIDS. But that's also how seductive theories get destroyed by harsh facts. Science is organized skepticism. Our scientific knowledge and capability is actually surprisingly patchy. Odd though it may seem, some of the best understood phenomena are far away in the cosmos. Right back in the 17th century, Isaac Newton could describe the clockwork of the heavens and predict eclipses. But few other things are so predictable. For instance, it's still hard to forecast, even a day before, whether those who go to view an eclipse will encounter clouds or clear skies. And guidance on some everyday matters, aspects of diet and childcare, for instance, still changes from year to year. If you ask scientists what they're working on, you seldom get an inspirational reply like seeking to cure cancer or understanding the universe. They focus on a tiny piece of the puzzle. They tackle something that seems tractable. They're not ducking the grand challenges, but they're judging that an oblique approach can pay off best. A frontal attack may be premature. For instance, 40 years ago, President Richard Nixon declared a war on cancer. He envisaged this as a national goal, modelled on the then recent Apollo moon landing programme. But there was a crucial difference. The science underpinning Apollo was already understood. So when funds gushed at NASA, it became reality. But in the case of cancer, the scientists knew too little to be able to target their efforts effectively. As another example, this time hypothetical, suppose a 19th century innovator had wanted to develop better machines to reproduce music. He could have made very elaborate mechanical organs or pianolas, but wouldn't have accelerated the advent of radio or the MP3 player. By the way, I'm using the word science throughout in a broad sense to encompass technology and engineering. This is not just to save words, but because they are symbiotically linked. Problem solving motivates us all, whether one is an astronomer probing the remote cosmos or an engineer facing a down-to-earth design conundrum. There's at least as much challenge in the latter, a point neatly made by an old cartoon showing two beavers looking up at a hydroelectric dam. One beaver says, "I didn't actually build it, but it's based on my idea." Nixon's cancer program, incidentally, facilitated a lot of good research into genetics and the structure of cells. Indeed, the overall investment in scientific research in the 20th century paid off abundantly. But the payoff happens unpredictably and after a time lag that can be decades long. And that, of course, is why much of science has to be funded as a public good. A fine case study is the laser, invented in 1960. It applied basic ideas that Einstein had developed more than 40 years earlier, and its inventors, in turn, didn't foresee that lasers would be used in eye surgery and in DVD players. Traditionally, discoveries reach public attention only after surviving peer review. But this copybook procedure is under increasing strain due to competitive or commercial pressures, 24-hour media, and the greater scale and diversity of a scientific enterprise that's now widely international. A conspicuous departure from traditional norms happened back in 1989 when Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann, then at the University of Utah, claimed at a press conference to have generated nuclear power using a tabletop apparatus. If credible, this cold fusion fully merited the hype it aroused. It would have ranked as one of the most momentous breakthroughs since the discovery of fire. But doubt set in. Extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence, and in this case, the evidence proved far from robust. Others failed to reproduce what Pons and Fleischmann claimed they'd done. Within a year, there was a consensus that the results were misinterpreted, though even today a few believers remain. Cold fusion bypassed the normal quality controls of the scientific profession. But it did no great harm in the long run. Indeed, in any similar episode today, exchanges via the internet would have led to a consensus verdict even more quickly. But this fiasco holds an important lesson. What's crucial in sifting error and validating scientific claims is open discussion. Suppose that Pons and Fleischmann had worked not in a university, but in a lab whose mission was military or commercially confidential. What would have happened then? If those in charge were convinced that they'd stumbled on something stupendous, a massive program might have got underway, shielded from open scrutiny and wasting huge resources. Indeed, just such waste has occurred more than occasionally in military laboratories. The imperative for openness and debate is a common thread through all the examples I've discussed. It ensures that any scientific consensus that emerges is robust and firmly grounded. Even wider discussion is needed when what's in contention is not the science itself, but how new findings should be applied. Such discussion should engage all of us as citizens and, of course, our elected representations, not just the scientists. Sometimes this has happened, and constructively too. In the UK, ongoing dialogue with parliamentarians led to a generally admired legal framework on embryos and stem cells, a contrast to what happened in the US. But we've had failures too. The GM crop debate was left too late, to a time when opinion was already polarised between eco campaigners on the one side and commercial interests on the other. But what about ideas beyond the fringe, the illusory comfort and assurance of the pseudosciences? Here there is less scope for debate. Both sides don't share the same methods or play by the same evidence-based rules. I've not found it fruitful to have much dialogue with astrologers or with creationists. A word now about communicating science. I mentioned Darwin earlier. Back in 1860, his book, The Origin of Species, was a bestseller, readily accessible, even fine literature, as well as an epochal contribution to science. But what scientists today call the literature isn't accessible in this way at all. But its essence can generally be conveyed, free of jargon and mathematics, by skilled communicators. Incidentally, we scientists habitually bemoan the meagre public grasp of our subject. And of course, all citizens need some understanding if policy debates are to get beyond tabloid slogans. But maybe we scientists protest too much. On the contrary, we should be gratified and surprised that there's wide interest in such remote topics as dinosaurs, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, or alien life. And we should just as much deplore public ignorance of history or geography. It's indeed sad if some citizens can't distinguish a proton from a protein, but equally so if they can't find Korea or Syria on a map. And many can't, and therefore are excluded from much political debate. Misperceptions about Darwin or dinosaurs are an intellectual loss, but no more. In the medical arena, however, they could be a matter of life and death. Hope can be cruelly raised by claims of miracle cures. Exaggerated scares can distort healthcare choices, as happened over the MMR vaccine. When reporting a particular viewpoint, journalists should clarify whether it is widely supported or whether it's contested by 99% of specialists. Noisy controversy need not signify evenly balanced arguments. Of course, the establishment is sometimes routed and the maverick vindicated. We all enjoy seeing this happen. But such instances are rarer than is commonly supposed. Scientists should expect media scrutiny. Their expertise is crucial in areas that fascinate us and matter to us all. And they shouldn't be bashful in proclaiming the overall promise that science offers. I'll end, as I began, with a flashback. This time to the atomic scientists who developed the first nuclear weapons during World War II. Fate had assigned them a pivotal role in history. Many of them returned with relief to peacetime academic pursuits. But the Ivory Tower wasn't for them a sanctuary. They continued not just as scientists, but as engaged citizens, promoting efforts to control the power they had helped unleash. These men, Jill Rotblat, Hans Bethe and the others, were an elite group, the alchemists of their time, possessors of secret knowledge. The dominant issues today, in contrast, span all the sciences. They're far more open and often global. There's less demarcation between experts and laypersons. Campaigners and bloggers enrich the debate. But professionals have special obligations to engage. The atomic scientists were fine exemplars. Scientists shouldn't be indifferent to the fruits of their ideas. They should try to foster benign spin-offs, commercial or otherwise, and they should resist as far as they can dubious or threatening applications. Unprecedented pressures confront the world, but there are unprecedented prospects too. The benefits of globalization must be fairly shared. And there's a widening gap between what science allows us to do and what is prudent or ethical actually to do. There are doors that science could open, but which are best left closed. Everyone should engage with these choices, but their efforts must be leveraged by scientific citizens, scientists from all fields of expertise, engaging from all political perspectives with the media and with the public attuned to the scope and limits of science. Thank you very much.
On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, you're listening to the 2010 Reith Lectures, Scientific Horizons with Professor Martin Rees. Today, part one, scientific citizens. And I suspect you'll agree with him when he says, what is crucial in sifting error and validating scientific claims is open discussion. It ensures that any scientific consensus that emerges is robust and firmly grounded. Anyway, let's go back to the radio theatre at Broadcasting House in London for some questions from the floor with Martin Rees and Sue Lawley.
I'm going for a question, first of all, from Dr. David Ellerman, who's a consultant in community childcare at Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital.
I agreed with most of what you said, but you touched on the MMR debacle. And this was one example where people didn't follow your logic, which was if they have a medical issue, they will listen to a medical practitioner. In this instance, they didn't listen to most of the medical practitioners. They listened to celebrities and newspaper people in the audience. But the
well,
media
I think they
well.
Also listened to the wrong medical expert, didn't they?
That was going to be my question. Mm-hmm. How do you help people decide which information they value, they listen to, when they're confronted with all the information you mentioned on the internet?
How can the layperson know, Martin, which is the correct expert?
Well, first, I didn't imply that people actually did view the internet in a discerning way. I said it would be better if they did. But, of course, it isn't easy, particularly in the case when you have people who have similar paper qualifications taking quite different views. And here again, I think there is a role for, in a sense, the leaders of the profession, but also for journalists and commentators who do have the chance to go round and get a fair sample of opinion. And I think what went wrong was that certain segments of the press did not present things in a balanced way. They presented equally what was a maverick viewpoint and what was a majority viewpoint. So I think, although some parts of the press were responsible, others were highly irresponsible, and I think they should take the blame.
Well, we've got the science editor of The Times on the front row, Mark Henderson. I think you're on the spot, Mr. Henderson.
Yes, I hope that The Times was one of the media outlets that was responsible in this respect. And I think we did, I think, always take the view that we should behave as Martin said and evaluate claims. And in fact, it would be interesting to ask Martin to what extent he thinks the media has a role, in fact, often not to be directly objective or narrowly objective and balanced in discussion of issues like this, and to what extent it's actually incumbent on responsible journalists to evaluate competing claims and offer a view as to their relative merits.
Well, I think you would accept that other newspapers were not as responsible as you were, and they in fact have a lot to answer for in that they maintain this controversy.
Well, hold on, I'll come back to you. Go on.
Okay, but I would have thought that it was appropriate that journalists should try and present what the balance of argument is on a particular issue.
But should they be evaluating it themselves, really, Mr. Henson's asking?
Well, I mean, obviously they don't have the expertise if it's a technical matter, but journalists tend to have a wide network of contacts, and they can, either through their contacts or by going indirectly to them, get a feel for what the consensus view is. Of course, the consensus isn't always right, but I think what they should be doing is reporting a consensus if there is one.
Was that Dr. Ellerman who wanted to come back in there? There was a call from the back there. Mm-hmm. Someone, is it on this subject, sir?
Well, it's on the subject of the media. David Nutt, one of those scientific advisors who tried to tread the line between policy and science found that the line had disappeared, and so I went over the cliff.
Shall we just say, for people listening, you were the former chairman of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs.
That's right.
Who resigned because...
No, I was sacked.
You were sacked. Let's be clear.
I refuse to resign.
It was felt that you crossed the line between scientific advice and policy.
Yes, I think there are many questions I could ask you, Martin. But I think that the challenge we have at present is that we have a relatively educated citizen, but in Parliament we have very few MPs who seem to understand evidence or science. And I presume one of the main roles of the Royal Society is to try to balance out that inexperience with the experience of 350 years of scientific progress. And I just wonder how you're going to take on this challenge, given that the Shadow Home Secretary said when I was sacked that it should have happened a lot sooner, because I wrote a paper that tried to balance out the relative harms of ecstasy and horse riding.
Well, I won't comment on what's going to be called the nutcase. But I will address the question of the small number of scientifically informed people in Parliament. Of course, all learned societies should engage with politicians to try and interest them. It is sad that there are rather few who are expert in science among the new intake, but that in itself doesn't matter, because if we look back on those who were active in scientific areas in the last Parliament, they weren't all people with a scientific training, just as the best scientific journalists aren't always people with scientific training. So I think, although we have started off in the Royal Society by focusing on those who seem to have some sort of scientific background, it wouldn't surprise me if those in the new Parliament who show the greatest interest in science and scientific matters will be people who didn't have a scientific background.
Let me bring in someone who's chairman of a body that I know you feel works very well, and that's the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, the HFEA, Professor Lisa Jardine. Professor Jardine, your
question. Thank you. I think, listening to what has been said, one of the issues that I face as chair of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority is that you ask for an engagement between the public in general, parliamentarians, those who are not experts, with science. I try to do that. It's one of my responsibilities to communicate difficult issues in IVF stem cell research to that broader public, and you were nice enough to say that we had done quite well in some areas. But there is a fundamental difficulty, which is that the public and decision makers want the right answers right now, whereas science, as I think you elegantly said, trades in organized doubt. It deals with statistical likelihoods. It deals with provisional outcomes based on the available evidence. So how are we going to engage with the public that wants to know whether it's red wine that causes breast cancer or whether eating fewer chips will give you less prostate cancer?
And they want to know now.
They want to know now.
Yes. Well, I think we have to make clear that science does have its limits, and hope people will be encouraged to support further research in science. But I think people have to realise that the key questions, I mentioned some in my lecture, are not yet solved. One consequence of what you're saying is that people have an irrational way of comparing different risks. They fret too much about some minor risks. As to what we do about it, I would not have thought it's only scientists who confront this problem. There are other areas where clearly there are uncertainties, and people have to accept that we have to make judgments on the basis of probabilities in many contexts, and I thought not just in science.
Let me bring in somebody who knows something about the public perception of risk. He's David Spiegelhalter, and he is the Winton Professor of the Public Understanding of Risk at Cambridge University, and he tried a few weeks ago to predict the football results and got them entirely wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, that was deliberate. It was quite deliberate. You appear to speak approvingly, for example, of the government response to swine flu, but I think many people, the popular opinion would be that that might have been an overreaction. I mean, the problem with low probability, high consequence events is that they hardly ever happen, and we're deeply uncertain about what the probabilities and the consequences might be. I mean, you would like to take a more rational, perhaps insurance-based approach, but how are you actually going to do that in the face of these really deep uncertainties without the public continually accusing the scientists of crying wolf about things that just don't happen?
Yes. Well, of course, many of the things we should worry about have a less than 50% probability. And you could take the view we don't take any precautions if the chance is less than 50%. But that's not the attitude we take when getting fire insurance for our house. and many people are aware that you do insure against things which have a much less than 50% chance probability, and therefore in those contexts people accept that they are likely to waste their money because what they're insuring against won't happen. And it seems to me that that was entirely analogous to what was done in stocking up for vaccine. The chance might have been less than 50%, but if you multiply the probability by the consequences, it was not necessarily foolish. I don't have enough expert knowledge in that particular case, but there are surely many cases when there's much less than 50% chance of something happening, but nonetheless, it is worth a major investment to guard against it.
We have someone in the audience, and we really should hear from her because she knows all about swine flu. She's Professor Wendy Bartlett, a virologist at Imperial College, with specialist knowledge of exactly this.
When one doesn't know how severe this particular pandemic virus might be, one needs to make decisions based on incomplete knowledge. And I think it's very important to try and get that concept across to the public, because I find that quite often people don't understand the difference between a vaccine and a drug, a vaccine that you do before the event. So I think that's perhaps pertinent to this issue, that, of course, the consequence of the pandemic is so severe.
And the consequence of the media writing about it is that you, in the end, the public feels that you have overreacted. That's the problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. But if this particular virus had turned out to be more of a 1918-type scenario, and we hadn't purchased vaccine in advance and made it available to the majority of the population, then everything would have sounded different. Yes.
Well, that is my main point. I think it's unfair to blame the government for what they did in preparing for the swine flu vaccine. And to go back to David Spiegelhalter, I think there are cases when it is right to take precautions against something which is more likely not to happen than to happen, if that thing is potentially very serious.
I've got a question here from Oliver Morton. Tell us what you do and who you are.
I'm Oliver Morton. I'm the energy and environment editor of The Economist. You said in your talk that scientists are their own fiercest critics, but when we actually come to media presentations of scientific controversy, you very, very rarely have a controversy where there are eminent scientists on both sides. It tends much more to be science on one side, critics on the other. So the question is, are the media just covering the wrong things, and there are lots of great stories where scientists are pitted against each other that we're just missing, or are the sort of internecine criticisms within science not actually germane to the world outside?
There are certainly many debates within science. I mean, as you know, within my own field of astronomy and cosmology, there have been very long-standing debates and vendettas between those who believe different things about the universe. So there are lots of cases when there are internal debates within science, and, of course, in the early stages of any investigation, there are a whole lot of views in contention. It may take some time before one emerges. And I think the question really is, at what extent the public is likely to be interested and needs to be informed? Is it better to wait until a consensus has emerged among the specialists before this becomes something which is widely known, or should the debate be public at early stages? I think if it's interesting, then there's no reason why the internal debate among experts should not be publicised. But the public is, as we said earlier, more concerned about what is certain or nearly certain than about things which are admitted to be very uncertain by the experts. And so the public may not be all that interested in these internal debates, although in things like cosmology, to my surprise, they were very interested.
I see Robert Winston, Lord Winston, there. Would you like to put a question?
I do wonder a bit about your comment about, you say that we should hand the information to governments who have to take the decisions. If you look historically, whether governments have been totalitarian, oligarchic, or totally democratic, they have always tended to misuse science. Surely isn't really the answer to ensure greater scientific literacy amongst the public, and actually from the scientists to ensure more literacy about the public? We've heard a lot about the public understanding. I think the public do understand things. I think that we actually have to listen rather more. Do you feel that that should be in your agenda?
Well, I agree with all that, and I hope I didn't say that we just leave everything to the government and pay no regard to what they do. What I did, however, say was that when a decision has dimensions which are not just science, but are ethics, economics, and politics, it is not just the scientific element of the decision that has to be considered. And there may be others where the scientists are not special experts. But I certainly wasn't saying that the scientists should leave it to the politicians and not try and engage. Clearly they should. But the influence which they have is not only directly as science advisors to politicians, but also indirectly by talking to the public and the media, getting their views in the press, which is then read by the wider public and filters to the politicians that way.
I have a question here from Alam Shaha, who's a science teacher.
I don't know if you know, but in 2006, the National Curriculum for Science changed to introduce something called How Science Works, which I think was intended to kind of improve scientific literacy. Do you think we need to go further in differentiating between the education we provide for so-called future scientists and scientifically literate citizens?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, science is not just for those who are going to be professional scientists, and it is quite right that there should be different approaches. I mean, I think we do need to try very hard to ensure that some feel for science is given to those who are not going to pursue it further, because otherwise the debate on all these important questions we've been discussing won't get above the level of tabloid slogans.
Let me call in Dr. Chandrika Nath, who's a physicist. You have a question for us, I think.
My question's actually on a slightly different theme, if that's okay. It's about science in the context of developing countries.
Just tell us what you do.
Well, I work for the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology, and my main job is to advise UK MPs about science issues. But I'm also involved in a programme to help the Parliament of Uganda handle scientific issues better. So, Lord Rees, in your talk, you mentioned that we should all have a voice in how science is applied in the developing world, as well as the developed world. What I'd like to ask is, to what extent do you think that scientists in the developed world influence the agenda of developing countries, and do you think this is appropriate?
I think it's important that they should respond when asked and make their expertise available, and I think there have been some positive developments recently. I mean, for instance, there's traditionally been an undue focus on diseases of the rich, cancer and heart diseases, and not on tropical infectious diseases. And the Gates Foundation has made a big shift, a big rebalance by supporting big programs in those. So that's an example where an enlightened funder can, in fact, have an effect which I suspect you would applaud in rebalancing the effort towards concern with the developing part of the world. And I would have thought that what we ought to do, and certainly in Royal Society we try to do this, is to engage with the academies of countries in Africa and elsewhere and do all we can to ensure that they are plugged in to the international community and also be aware to their agenda. But obviously, one must not do this in a way that's seen to be, as it were, imposing on them. But one hopes that countries which are so lacking in range of expertise will be able to draw more on what comes in the developed world. And, of course, this is a case where the internet and modern developments have been a tremendous boon, I would have thought.
If I could just follow up on that. I think in practice, what happens is that with the best intentions, there are so many donors, and particularly with science, so many different sorts of organisations trying to help out in the developing world, that you end up with a plethora of activities. So, for example, biosafety, managing pathogens in laboratories in the developing world, it's a big issue for the West because of fears over bioterrorism, but is the amount of funding going into that in the developing world proportionate to the problems those countries face?
Quick comment, if you would, Martin.
Yes, well, I can't judge, but I think the important thing is to take advice from those on the ground, as it were, as to what the priorities should be.
I'm going to Sue Blackmore. Would you tell us, Sue Blackmore, what you do before you put your question?
I'm a visiting professor in psychology at the University of Plymouth. You started, Martin, by applauding the idea of the founders of science that we should accept nothing on authority. Great, but that was different in those days when an intelligent scientist could actually try out everything for themselves. Now science is so complex, requires so much money, so much equipment, so much knowledge. In effect, I, as a scientist in one field, have to take on authority almost everything else in science. Should I?
I think it's inevitable that you have to. You can't repeat the experiments made by all your colleagues in different fields. But I think it's very important that there should be some cross-calibration. That's why people need to get out of their disciplinary ghettos, and that's why there is a role for scientific commentators and critics, such as the best scientific journalists, because they, in fact, have a network that's spreads across different subjects, and they can calibrate the quality of work in different fields. It's very important that should be done. But obviously, it's not like it was in the 1660s when we could follow the whole of science ourselves.
But I'm going for a last question now, which is a good bit of buck passing, from Ian Hansen. Tell us what you do, and I'm quite sure you're a scientist.
Hi, I'm a radiotherapy physicist at the Royal Marsden Foundation Trust. This idea that scientists are simply locked up in their laboratory, not willing to communicate concepts, is not something that I see. Most of the scientists I know are very eager on sharing information. They do this on the blogs, on the internet. If you meet a scientist in the pub and ask them what they do, there's a good chance you're going to be stuck there for the next 10 minutes. So certainly a bit of responsibility lies with the public in the actual wanting of them to actually understand this concept and to be not taken for a ride when it comes to MMR and such like.
That's right. I think we should do all we can to engage scientists with the wider public. But I think you're right in saying that even if scientists as individuals try very hard, then, of course, if their audience is limited to those for whom they can buy around in the pub, that's rather limited. And so I think we are going to depend on the media. So I think the link between scientists and the media is very important. And then the media amplify their voice, and the BBC in particular amplifies the voice of scientists, particularly this year, which is excellent. And that's the way in which we can gradually raise consciousness. But I do want to say that things are not that bad. I really meant it when I said that just as debate on science is handicapped by the fact that people don't understand what's a protein and what's a proton, it's just as bad that people can't debate the Middle East or Afghanistan properly because they don't know where these places are on the map, they don't know the history. So ignorance is an impediment to proper engagement of citizens, whether it's in science or in other areas. And I think scientists shouldn't claim that they're worse off than others. But on the other hand, science is going to be of increasing importance in the 21st century, and it's therefore crucial that we should do all we can through our friends in the media to engage with the public and ensure they get as undistorted as possible a view of the scientific discoveries.
Thank you to you all. Next week we'll be in Cardiff, where Professor Rees will be revealing his optimism about scientists providing answers to our global problems, but some pessimism about the politicians and the sociologists who put them into practice. I hope you'll tune in then. For now, Martin Rees, Rees Lecturer 2010. Thank you very much indeed.
The link between scientists and the media is very important, and then the media amplify their voice, and that's the way in which we can gradually raise awareness of vital issues. Indeed, Professor Rees, but not just at the BBC, but right here as well at the ABC. That was President of the Royal Society of London and Astronomer Royal, Lord Martin Rees, and the first of the 2010 Rees Lecture Series from the BBC. And don't forget, if you'd like to hear this lecture again or leave a comment, just head to our website. That's abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. And thanks today to Sue Clark. I'm Robin Williams, and I hope you can catch me next Saturday after the news at noon for the Science Show. And of course, next week at this time for the second in the Rees Lecture Series here on ABC Radio National. Bye for now.
The US Congress has passed a law that requires all mining companies operating offshore to disclose the payments they make to foreign governments. Should Australia follow the US lead and also commit to greater transparency in the resources industry, particularly when our companies are operating in the developing world? In the National Interest, with me, Peter Mayers. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.